On the second page, we were at the Kintu Andhakare. We did the first half of this long sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody there?
Mm-hmm.
So, it's talking about how knowledge works in terms of Pallavyapti and Vrittivyapti. And we're saying Vrittivyapti. So he gives an example. He says, he says how, in the previous sentence, how Brahman, you know, the Vritti cannot illumine Brahman like a lamp illumines things that are external to it. Like that, Brahman cannot be known because Brahman is not objectified like an object that I can shine a light on. Brahman is the light. Right? So because Brahman is the light, I have to remove all of the things that are associated with that. You know, all the things that are taking themselves to be that. So all of those things have to be negated, bunga, broken. So the example he uses is, you know, that rather than the Pallavyapti, which is necessary to come in and illumine the object, here he says, kintu rather, giving the example, andhakare, in the darkness, gata adi avrita ratna pradipa adihi yata. He says, just as a jewel, a ratna, a precious stone, or a pradipa, a light or a lamp, are covered by a pot or something like that. There are other examples where we use a pot and you put a light, you put a lamp, a light in the pot, put a lamp in the pot, but then you can't see the lamp because the lamp's in the pot. You can't see the light, right? So the light is covering, as though covering the light that is there. So what he says is, just as, you know, if we were to break the pot, which is covering the jewel or covering the lamp, then that light is going to shine on its own. We just have to remove the obstruction. We have to remove the obstruction that is stopping me from seeing the light in its own right. So by just that one act of removing the obstruction, and here, in terms of Vrittivyapti, the obstruction is ajnana, is ignorance. So simply by having the vritti land on the object, the ignorance is removed. But usually the consciousness is necessary to then illumine the object itself. So there's these two things that are happening simultaneously. But here, in terms of self-knowledge, that thing of shining to illumine the self is not necessary. Just like with this example, we just have to break the pot or break whatever it is that is covering that which is self-evident. So that's the example that's being used. But now he says, swayam eva prakashate. The light or the lamp reveals it itself once the obstruction is removed, which is much different than having to have a vritti and then illumine the vritti. That happens, that need to illumine the vritti is because the vritti or the object of the vritti is not self-evident. It's not self-luminous. And so naturally we have to kind of bring in a light to light it up. But you don't have to bring in a light to light up something that is self-evident, that is light, the light itself, you know. And so now he continues on, gives an example. In having used the pot and the retina, the jewel and the light example, he says, so repeat after me, evam aham brahmasmi iti.
Evam aham brahmasmi iti.
Pramana janya.
Pramana janya.
Pramarupa.
Pramarupa.
Vrittihi.
Vrittihi.
Brahma avaraka.
Brahma avaraka.
Brahma avaraka.
Brahma avaraka.
Ajnana.
Ajnana.
Nashamatram.
Nashamatram.
Karoti.
Karoti.
Brahmatu.
Brahmatu.
Bhujyadi.
Bhujyadi.
Sadhana anantara.
Sadhana anantara.
Nirapeksham eva.
Nirapeksham eva.
Swasambaddha.
Swasambaddha.
Sarva avabhasakatva.
Sarva avabhasakatva.
Rupa.
Rupa.
Swajyotishtvena.
Swajyotishtvena.
Swayam jyotishtvena.
Swayam Jyotish
Dvaina. Nitya Aparoksha Rupa Tvat.
Nitya Aparoksha Rupa Tvat.
Swayam Patate.
Swayam Patate.
Okay. So here it says, Avan, in the same manner as the pot being broken, Avan, in the same manner, Aham Brahmasmi Iti, I am Brahman, Mahavakya, I am Brahman. In the same manner, I am Aham Brahmasmi Iti, the putting in quotes, I am Brahman. I'm just going to read this through, and then I'll make it, I want you to know the vocabulary. Pramana, a means of knowledge. Pramana, the means of knowledge. Here's the Upanishad Pramana. Janya, that which is born of a means of knowledge. Pramana Janya. Pramana Janya Prama, the knowledge, Prama, which is born of a means of knowledge. So Pramana Janya Prama, Rupa Vrittihi. Vrittihi is the nominative, 1-1. So the thought modification, the vritti, which is whose nature is rupa, the, which is in the form of nature, its content is, so the vritti whose rupa is the knowledge which is born of the pramana, iti aham brahmasmi. The prama, the knowledge is I am Brahman. And that knowledge is born of the pramana, which allows me to recognize my own nature through the lakshana vritti and all of the different prakriyas, teaching methodologies that we use, that's utilizing the pramana, allows me to gain this knowledge, which is aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Okay, so this is the subject of the sentence. Vrittihi is the nominative. So this vritti, which is in the form of this pramana, the knowledge that's born of the pramana, this vritti, brahma avaraka ajnana nashamatram karoti. This vritti nashamatram karoti. That matra means kind of like it merely, it only does the destruction. So in English we would say it merely destroys. Mm-hmm. Now we're saying it does the destruction. Mm-hmm. We're not going to say that in English. Mm-hmm. Kriya can take any form. The verbal root kri means to do. So now it can do destruction, or it can do sweeping, or it can do reading, you know. So we're using a noun along with this verb. But in English, we just said, nashamatra merely destroys. So this vritti simply destroys, that's all. It merely destroys the ajnana, reading backwards, which avataka, which is a cover, acts as a covering. The ajnanam is the avataka. It does the covering of Brahman. So now we have Brahma, avataka, ajnana, nashamatram karoti. So this vritti, which is in the form of the knowledge, which is born of the pramana, the knowledge being aham brahmasmi, this pramana, this vritti, which is acting as the pramana, it merely removes the ajnanam, which is the covering, acting as the covering for Brahman. Okay. Brahma tu, so then it says, Brahma tu, buddhyadi sadhana anantara nirapeksham eva. Whereas Brahman, 1-1, buddhi adi sadhana anantara nirapeksham eva is definitely does not need right, nirapeksham, it doesn't need another antara sadhana anantara, it is not dependent on another sadhana. So sadhana antara nirapeksham eva, nirapeksham, it is not dependent on, okay, antara, another sadhana, such as adi, the buddhi. Buddhi adi, such as the buddhi. So buddhi adi sadhana anantara nirapeksham eva. So Brahman is not dependent upon another sadhana such as the buddhi to light it up, we really have to just get rid of the ajnanam and the buddhi, like the precious stone is just there, self-luminous. We've taken the pot off, removed the ajnanam. So then he says, swa sambandha sarva avabhasakatva rupa swayam jyotishtvena nitya aparoksha rupatvat swayam pratyate. So it says like this. Because of, we'll start with the nitya aparoksha rupatvat. Okay. Because of being in the form of nitya aparoksha, I just can't tell you, this is Vedanta vocabulary. Every word that you need to know is just packed in here. Every single word. These are all technical terms. Mm-hmm. The whole Vedanta is nice. Mm-hmm.
That's a great text.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, it's like a little precious thing. So, nitya aparoksha rupatvat. Nitya means timeless. Aparoksha. Aparoksha is a word that is directly related to the means of knowledge we have available to us. We have two major means of knowledge. One is direct means of knowledge. One is indirect means of knowledge. If I say something is a pramana, a means of knowledge is direct, in, and immediate, that means of knowledge is called pratyaksha. Now, pratyaksha means my sense organs. The sense organs give my mind direct, immediate knowledge. Like if I'm looking at the fire, I see the fire. I don't have to see the fire and then hop over to something else. If I have to see the fire and hop over to something else, that's indirect knowledge. Like, for instance, even what we call anumana. Anumana means inference. It's indirect, because inference would be, I see smoke on the hill, and I infer the fire because of an invariable concomitance between these two, smoke and fire. So if I see the smoke and I'm right about the smoke, there's fire there. Mm-hmm. If I'm wrong about the smoke, maybe it's just a cloud or mist or something, then there's no fire, but that's my mistake. If I see the smoke, I can infer the fire, but that's indirect. Mm-hmm. Right? If somebody gives me, if I'm reading a textbook on chemistry, indirect. Direct would be I have to be there with the chemicals and doing all the experiments myself. Then I'm directly experiencing it. But most of our knowledge, in fact, is indirect. Mm-hmm. Somebody tells you about a trip or an experience they had. You learn most of your knowledge, most of your education is indirect. Indirect is called paroksha. Means the aksha, the sense organs, are away from the object. Pratyaksha means the sense organs are within the vicinity. The objects are within the vicinity, within the range of the sense organs. Para means they're away from the sense organs. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's indirect knowledge, and most of the things that we learn are indirect. You imagine, we couldn't build up on knowledge, we couldn't build off of each other. Your knowledge couldn't build off of knowledge, off of knowledge. The other roots of our knowledge are way down here, we don't even know if they are anymore. You know, we've done so many inferences and so much building on top of it. So much of what, most of what we learn is paroksha. Yourself is here. You are here. So you're not out of range. You cannot have paroksha jnanam of yourself, right? Because you're here. But you can't have pratyaksha either, because pratyaksha requires the sense organs. So what do we say? You are aparoksha. You are not indirect. You can't be objectified by the sense organs. We can't even say that the knowledge of the self is of the type of pratyaksha, like, say, for instance, an emotion or an imagination or a dream or something. We'd say that is a type of pratyaksha that we call sakshi bhasya. It's an experience in the mind of vritti that has content which is illumined directly by the sakshi. But by the self. But it's not the self. Right? It's illumined. It's objectified. It exists within maya. So that's a type of pratyaksha. That's called sakshi bhasya, the inner experiences that I have. And then pratyaksha are the experiences that I have of the world through my sense organs. I'm not included in that. That's all within Maya. And I cannot be indirect. You can be, like the somebody, you can be, have indirect knowledge of yourself, like somebody, some pundit tells you all about the Vedanta, and you have to go and meet a guru, and the guru will tell you that you are Brahman, and then you'll realize that there's only one non-dual, you know, self. But that's not, that's indirect knowledge, but that's not really knowledge of you, you know. Mm-hmm. It's an indirect knowledge of you, which isn't what the Upanishads are meant to give. It's not moksha. The Upanishads say this, and I believe it. Well, belief is not knowledge. Or somebody's told me this is what, who I am, and I have Shraddha and the Vedas, so I believe I am Brahman. But I have no idea. I might as well say I believe I'm Gagabuga. I have no idea what it means. It's not knowledge. So the self, so there's two things here. One is that the self itself is called aparoksha because it is direct and immediate. It is present. It is not away. Yourself is not away. So your self experience right now is aparoksha jnanam. But the jnanam is just jnanam is just the experience of the self as a conscious being. So because it's only the experience of yourself as a conscious being, we say it's a samanya jnanam. It's a general knowledge, not a vishesha jnanam. So just to tell you what that means. All of us have a general knowledge. We all have a general knowledge of me, of myself. You know that you're a conscious being. You have a sense of me. You know you're not inert. You know you're the subject of your experience. All of these things we can all say. We all know that. And you can say, yes, I'm a conscious, existent being. But I don't know what it is. I have no context for it. I don't know if this conscious, existent being that I am, it's aparoksha, but I don't know. It's experientially aparoksha. But I don't know what it is in reference to the world. I don't know if it comes into being, goes out of being. I don't know what my being is in reference to your being. I don't know what my being is in reference to Ishwara, if there is an Ishwara. I just know I am a conscious, existent being. So that experience itself, it's called anubhava, the experience, is aparoksha, because my sense organs aren't giving me that experience. Nothing's giving me that experience. But I have that experience about myself. But it's a general knowledge, it's covered in ignorance. You know, it's shining brightly, covered in ignorance. It's, here I am, but I don't know who I am. I know I am, but I don't know who I am. Something like that. The example they use for it, for this type of knowledge, which I call salamanic, this general knowledge, is they use this for the rope snake example. You have salamanya jnanam of that snake. It's got five bends, right? It's an inch in diameter. You know, it's located in this particular position. It has some fangs sticking out. You know, it's just a perfect description of the rope. But you don't know it's a rope. That's kind of our situation. I can describe myself so beautifully, but I think, as far as I know, I'm describing an epiphenomenon of the body. Like me, a me that is time-bound and bound by space and bound by time and objectifiable. That's what I know. And yet the experience is aparoksha. Right? So we have that samanya, that general knowledge, which is aparoksha. Then you have aparoksha jnana. How does knowledge take place? It can't take place through your sense organs, and it can't be indirect. And so the knowledge that you're gaining through this lakshanavritti and through this vritti vyapti, you know, is aparoksha jnana. Because you can't use your sense for it, organs for it. It can't be sakshi basya. It can't be something that you're objective, mental state that you're objectifying, like we do with meditative states, for instance. Mm-hmm. I just had an experience of myself. Well, you know, that's fine to say as long as when that vritti goes away, that meditative vritti goes away, you're the one who's still left standing, then it's okay. Otherwise, if you think that I just had an experience of myself and now it's gone away, I wish I could have it again, then that's a jnana. You know, that's not aparoksha jnana. Aparoksha jnana means I have knowledge of myself, which can not be indirect and also which is not objectifiable as sense perception. So, here he says, because of being nitya aparoksha, why is it? Just take this last part. Nitya aparoksha rupa taught, because of its nature being nitya, timeless, and aparoksha, means shining of its own accord, swayam pratate, it reveals itself. It reveals itself when? Why? So it goes, because of being nitya aparoksha, swayam pratate, it reveals itself. Nobody has to reveal it. It self-reveals because it's you are self-luminous. Then he says, because of being jyoti shtwena, because of being swayam jyoti, self-luminous, twena, because of being jyoti shtwena, swayam jyoti shtwena, because of being self-luminous, in the form of a sarva avabhasakatva, in the form of one who is avabhasakatva, illumining everything that comes into its orb, swasambaddha. So whatever comes in, any experience that you have is known. Is known means it's illumined. You can never be without that experience. The nama rupas go on changing, internally, externally, but the in-knownness is nitya aparoksha, the is-knownness. It is known, it is. That's consciousness. That's just language describing me as consciousness. And that these words, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. Even if I have a nirvikalpa samadhi where the mind, the buddhi just turns to myself, it is known. It is known as the very swarupa, the very nature of consciousness itself. And that consciousness is self, self-shining, self-evident. Swayam itself, jyotish. Self-lit, self-shining, jyotish, jyotish-twena. Because of being self-shining, right, everything that comes into its orb is illumined. So it's the avabhasaka, it's the illuminator by its very nature, because it's light itself, of everything. And for us, for Ishwar, everything is the whole Maya Upadhi. The infinite Maya Upadhi. The whole thing is illumined by consciousness, because consciousness is knownness, so the whole Maya Upadhi is known. For you as a jiva, every vritti that you have, being sattva, is known. The is-knownness that the whole universe goes away, what is left is known, is consciousness, is me. And so this is known, this is known, this is known. But what instead of recognizing this is known, this is known, this is known, I think I know this, I know this, I know this, I know this, so then I get the concept of a knower. But there is no experience of a knower. There is an experience of is known, which is nitya aparoksha. It never changes. The is known never changes, the is known is Brahman. So you think of it internally, externally, in any way you look at it, what is there is known. And that's the invariable Brahman. So, here he says, because the Brahman is nitya aparoksha, it's ever present, it doesn't need a pramana to come and light it up, it's aparoksha. Because, why is it nitya, always aparoksha? Because it's self-luminous. You know? And because it's self-luminous, everything that comes into contact with it is known. It's the luminary. So actually, it's the ever-present luminary of all of the vrittis that come your way. So when the ajnanam is removed through the teaching methodologies, then what is left is me. Swayam pratyate, I reveal myself. It's like if you break the pot, the pot falls off, ta-da! There's the light of the lamp, or there's the luminosity of the jewel. It didn't do anything at all. It doesn't have to do anything. The ajnanam just has to be removed, and there you are. You have not done anything at all. Not only that, You have never not been there, which is your experience. You know, that's why this 10th man story is so wonderful. Because when the old man points out to the 10th man, having counted the other 9, you know, you are the 10th man. Weren't you there the moment before he said it? So what a strange thing. Because the Jiva Srishti now is totally different. Even though you have always been there and you know you've always been there and you know you were just confused once you know yourself. But there's no new experience. The new experience is just the Jiva Srishti, you know, the Kalpita, the imaginations of the Jiva settled down, which were quite intense because he was responsible for the death of the 10th man and all of this stuff, you know, all this emotional garb was huge, I'm sure. So as Swamiji tells it, it's really huge. So that's completely removed, but your self-experience is not removed at all. It's just the mistake is removed. The ignorance-born mistake. So the mind is completely different. Without that ignorance-born mistake, the mind is shashanti. With the ignorance-born mistake, it is very, very confused and upset and worried and all the things we suffer. So then he says, this last end of the paragraph, iti brahmanaha swaprakashat phubhurakam idam visheshanam. So you have to go back to hear the word swaprakasham. He's just told why swaprakasham is so important. Because all of the means of knowledge depend upon the fact that the self is self-luminous. So he says, thus, brahmanaha swaprakashatva bodhakam idam visheshanam. This attribute that we call swaprakasha, in this mangalacharanam that we're analyzing, we're still just analyzing this mangalacharanam. He says, this attribute, idam visheshanam, it teaches this bodhaka, okay? It's a teacher. It teaches the swaprakashatva of Brahman. So that's why this is important. The self-luminosity of Brahman. And you see why it's important because of everything that we've just read through. Does that make sense? And then he says, punascha, repeat after me, punascha tad brahma katam bhutam. So the questioner asks, says, now again, what is the nature of that Brahman? Tad Brahma, that Brahman, Katam Bhutam, what is that? What is the nature? How is that Brahman? What is that Brahman like? Nirmalam. It goes to another word. Nirmalam. So we've done Sukham, Nityam, Swaprakasham, Vyapakam, Namarupa, Yoho, Adishtanam, Bhujabhujam, Budehe, Vrityatu, Nirmalam. He's done most of these. Now he's doing Nirmalam, and you see how there's that little question mark there, and the little equal signs, yes. Mm-hmm. And commas.
Yes.
That's the editor trying to help us.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. So he says, he even gives a little question mark. Then Nirmalam means Shuddham. Shuddham means pure. Nirmalam means without impurity. That means shuddham. Apadam, the word apadam, that means desha. Remember, apadam means there's no end. It's boundless.
No
other shore, right? Mm-hmm. So apadam means desha, kala, vastu, parichinnam, cha bhavati. He says, desha, space, or place, kala, time, vastu, the object, aparichinnam, vastu, upas a is va. Okay, for Sunday.
Yeah.
Desha, kala, vastu, aparichinnam cha bhavati. So apara means that which is not limited or not bound. Aparichinnam means to have boundaries around something, to have limit something, it's a delimiter. So aparichinnam means there's no boundaries, there's no limitation of place, space, desha. of Desha, of place, of Kala, of time, of Vastu. As we'll see in the footnotes, Vastu means Padartha. This is a Padartha. It means an object. It's not an object. It doesn't have the limitations of being an object. And then it goes to all of these footnotes. We'll go through all the footnotes tomorrow. That would be nice. Footnotes are really amazing. Om Tat Sat. Now we can. It's only 8:11. We can have a little satsang. If you're so inclined.
I have a question about the earlier part. We said that the direct meaning shakti of words,
yeah,
that's not going to work. That it has to be indirect.
Implied.
Or implied.
That's not indirect.
Implied. Okay, because here you were saying that the indirect or the, yeah, the indirect won't work.
Nor will the direct. Neither one. When you're talking about the pramanas, the means of knowledge, there are actually six pramanas. There's pratyeksha, which is perception, then there's inference, and there's presumption. I can go into all of those, but
logic,
I think
it's,
yeah, anumana is inference, and then we have
absence.
Non-cognition, which is anupalabdhi, and artopathy is presumption. And then we
similarity.
Have shabda. So, yeah, we have similarity. What is that one called? Upamana, similarity. So, anyway, all this means is that there are six basic ways that we know things. One is through direct perception, really through sense perception. The others are all indirect, like inference. I see the smoke, not the fire, so I have to do something else. Right? For presumption, I wake up in the morning and everything is wet. Mm-hmm. So I presume that it rained, but I'm not experiencing the rain. I have to do something else. I'm only experiencing the wetness. And then upamana has to do with the example that they use is there's an animal, cow type animal called a gavaya, and these gavayas are in the forest. They look a lot like cows. They have this strange kind of dewlap coming down. You know, so if somebody, say a farmer has a cow, and then he is going out picking berries and whatnot in the forest, and he sees this thing that looks like his cow and has this dewlap, and he says, this must be a gavaya. Mm-hmm.
You know? Even though he's never seen one.
Even though he's never seen one. But in order to say that, he has to remember mm-hmm. his cow. Right, and so then with the memory of the cow, he can now say with some certainty that this is a gavaya. But he can't just say that. There's something else that has to take place. So that's all that indirect means. Something else has to take place in the mind in order to get to that knowledge. And then the non-cognition, that's a really interesting one. Like Swamiji would sometimes use the example, there's no elephant in the room. How do you know that? You're not seeing it. You can't say, because I don't see it. Because you don't see it. You don't see it, so how do you know it's not there? You see what I mean? Like
it's absence.
You have to recognize that because of everything that you do see, you don't see that. So there's and again, it's just another little shift. It's not included in the things that you do see. So that's different than saying what you do see. You have to do something else. You get it? And it's usually, this anupalabdhi is usually used in reference to an object like, I thought I put my glasses on the table. They're not on the table. I was sure I left them on the table, but they're not on the table. We have this kind of use of anupalabdhi all of the time. But I'm not seeing that they're not on the table. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing the table. So anyway, these are all indirect. The most common indirect, though, is through shabda, through the use of words. Because we're always using words to describe something to another person. And if they take you, have shraddha in you, as an apta, trust in you, as what we call an apta purusha. Apta purusha means a qualified person. Then you accept, you have shraddha in what they're saying to be true. So without that shraddha, you know, they can say whatever they want, but you don't have faith that they're an honest person or a knowledgeable person. So anyway, all of these means of knowledge have their own spheres, you know, whether they're direct or indirect. But whether direct or indirect, they're still depending upon objectification, even sense perception, or even the other kind of sense perception, which is called sakshibhasya, where you have a vritti that comes from the imagination or memory or something like that, and awareness illumines that. And so it's still, the self is not going to be something you can know through objectification, right? Or having a vritti land on it, you know.
So can you explain the pola vritti and the vyapta?
Yeah.
Vritti, why the vyapta vritti is closer than the pola one?
Pola, there's vritti vyapti and pola vyapti. Okay. Mm-hmm. But wait a minute. Let me do this. Finish this one little thing up first. I don't get lost in it all. So the question you had initially had to do with the use of indirect.
Mm-hmm.
And confusing that with the use of lakshana.
Mm-hmm.
So we were working on the shakti vritti and the lakshana vritti. Okay,
yes.
So now I've kind of tried to take care of the indirect.
Yeah.
What we mean by indirect knowledge. It's still objectified knowledge.
Right, because whether direct or indirect,
neither one.
Because they require objects.
That's right, and that's why we can't say that we gain this through pratyaksha or through paroksha. Direct or indirect. That's why we call it a paroksha,
mm-hmm.
where the a negates the paroksha. That just means not, this knowledge is not indirect. It's not paroksha jnanam, it's a paroksha. It's not indirect. It can't be because it's you. You can't have indirect knowledge of yourself. Okay, so then with that, now we go into the vritti vyapti and the phala vyapti. So, but first we go into the shakti vritti. The shakti vritti and the lakshana vritti.
Yeah.
Okay. Shakti vritti is a problem because the shakti vritti is the immediate meaning of a word which is going to exist within duality. And we gave those examples like the red runs and the village on the Ganga. You know, and the one that applies to us, the wave ocean example. These are all examples that if you take the primary meaning of the word, it won't work because there is no village sitting on the Ganga. It's on the banks of the Ganga. There is no red color that runs. There could be a red horse that runs, but not red, right? So the Shakti Vritti doesn't even it takes place in the world all of the time. We use the shakti vritti, but sometimes the shakti vritti of a word, the immediate meaning of the word, doesn't work. So immediately our mind goes into the lakshana vritti, you know, which will work unless the person's crazy and saying, look at the red running, and they're serious that there's some red, the red color is running, so you, psychosis is, you know. But when we use it just normally, like, look at all the umbrellas, Bill. Well, that's another stock example. It's monsoon. Look at all of the umbrellas going. As though they're just all walking along, you know? You know very well. You supply. The people are walking and they all have umbrellas. We use this all the time. So now we take that fact that we can use implication. And that we do that. And so in terms of this knowledge, the immediate meanings of the words cannot work. Because the immediate meaning of the word are just of objects and experiences within duality. But we couldn't talk otherwise. If there was no Shakti Vritti there, even the Lakshana comes off of the Shakti Vritti, right? And so now what we have to do in this teaching methodology is we use these words, you know, but we use the words and then we strip from the words through the teaching all of the aspects of the word that belong to duality. So say, these are the words. Sat, existence. Existence is in a sense, it's a Shakti Vritti, because we know what we mean. What we really mean is, this thing is here, so it exists. You know, I am here, so I exist. Everything that is exists. So it all has to do with objectification and with the presence of an object. You know, if you take the, you don't think of existence as a noun. But we have to make existence into a noun. We don't have existence as a noun. It's just an attribute of things that are versus things that are not, like some things that are non-existent or things that were absolute non-existent. They never were. So we know what that means. It's non-existence. It's not here. That's what it means. Whereas we're using existence as a noun. And you can't look at some existence. You can't look at existence. You can look at things that exist. But we have this word existence, and we have the experience of my own amness. But you take that experience of your own amness to belong to this body. So that's how we use the word. But now we have to show that the amness exists. The existence exists really as the amness which I am, and to have it be that, I have to strip off all of the things that were superimposed upon it. And that's the process of getting to that Lakshana. You know, just because it's the same existence. We use the same word. You know, but that existence, so if you take it like that, the word existence, the same word, but we say that that existence is consciousness, is chit, you know. And so now what do we know what consciousness is, and we know what existence is, but we don't know what existence consciousness is. Yeah. And then we say it is such ananda, it is limitless. So the Taittiriya Upanishad, there's a really long bhasha by Shankara on this analysis of these words which really define you, how to get there. We use the words and strip off the upadis from the words. Which we can do, like I could do it immediately for you, like just in the Driktrisha Viveka, you know, the fact that once I say, you know, your body is known through your sense organs, mm-hmm. all of a sudden the sense organs become the me and the body becomes the object that's objectified. If we say the sense organs themselves are known, objectified by the mind, all of a sudden, you know, the sense organs are objects, and I, the conscious being, am the mind that objectifies these sense organs, which can be there or not. If I lose a sense organ, I lose an instrument. I don't lose myself. So all of these kind of talk takes the upadis, or stripping the upadis off my being, just by the simple act of objectifying them. The existence remains the same, minus what we call really the immediate meaning of the word. I've stripped off an upadi, so now the conditioning adjunct. So now the immediate meaning of the word is not what it used to be. It's moved inward. And then when I take off the mind, I realize that the mind itself is objectified and is known, but I still am. You know? I still am. I still am a conscious being. Separated now from the mind that is objectified and that changes. I become the stable, the nitya, aparoksha, atma, you know, ever the same, self-evident atma, swaprakasha, self-evident atma, that is the luminary, illumining all these changing phenomena that I had taken to be me, each one of them. take the mind to be me, you take the buddhi to be you, you take the ahankara to be you, the sense organs to be you, your emotions to be you, you know. But each one of these is removed, and I still am. Even if you think in meditation, you're turning your mind away from the world and from the body and from the thoughts just to be with yourself. But somebody has to point out what you're doing. You know, you're just meditating, but you don't realize that actually you're just being with yourself, you know, not identified with the body, mind, sense organs, not paying attention, not objectifying them. Usually you don't notice that you're objectifying them, you just are, but you don't think about it, what that means. Anyway, going on too much. So that's the shakti of the word, and the lakshana of the word. Then we have to look at the vritti-vyapti and pola-vyapti.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the vritti-vyapti and pola-vyapti is just telling how knowledge takes place when you're trying to gain knowledge of something that's not objectifiable. You know, that's the situation. If it's not objectifiable and it's not you, then you're out of luck. Right? If it's not the adhishtana, then there's not anything you can do. It's not objectifiable. There's no way for it to be known. In fact, how can you even say it is known? You can't. But because you are self-evident, you know, all that has to happen here is, in terms of vritti-vyapti and pola-vyapti, is in the world, you have the vritti-vyapti, pola-vyapti happening really simultaneously. The vritti takes on the form of the object. That's all it does. It takes on the form of the object, but the vritti is taking place in consciousness. So the object is known. If the consciousness was not there, what we call the chittabhas, if that was not there, the vritti would take on the form of the object and nothing would happen. It needs to be illumined because the object is not self-luminous. So if consciousness is not there, even though the vritti takes on the form of the object, it's just still all inert. There's no consciousness, there's no knowership, there's no knowledge taking place. Without the chittabhas or without the consciousness, no knowledge takes place, it's just inert. So in the world, you need the vritti-vyapti, the vritti to pervade the object, and you need the object to be illumined. Both are necessary, because the vritti, the object, is not self-evident, right? But in terms of knowing yourself, the thing is, you are the consciousness because of which the vritti is illumined. So if the mind is directed toward its own adhishtana, its own being, which is the Satchitananda, right, then there's vritti-vyapti takes place. Where is now consciousness needed to come and illumine that? It's not, because the vritti has taken on the form of consciousness as though. So the vritti-vyapti takes place and that's the end of it. Because it's self-evident. Consciousness is self-evident. So these are just all the different tools we're playing with to make the mind understand how knowledge of the self actually takes place. Because it can't take place in the same way that it takes place in the world. In the world, there's a subject-object relationship involved. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Can there be can there be a vritti-vyapti without a pala-vyapti? They're always...
Well, you have to be dead or something.
You mean just like the brain is moving, but there's
yeah.
no consciousness? Like
yeah.
The neurons are firing, but there's no consciousness or something
weird.
Like,
weird
who
like
knows
that.
What.
No consciousness.
Right.
And so there would be no knowledge.
But why then do they really divide it into those two, since always they're always simultaneous, right?
Because there's two functions.
Okay.
And the point is that there's really nothing, including the vritti, sattva, rajas, and tamas, there's nothing which is itself consciousness, self-luminous. Everything is illumined. The whole maya is mitya. So there's not a second consciousness involved. the Satchitananda is absolutely pervasive in reference to the whole creation. It's not pervasive at all, it's non-dual.
Mm-hmm.
But from the standpoint of the creation, the Adhishtana means the truth of the mitya, that what is there is the self. But there's no way for the mitya, you know, to objectify that self, to have a subject-object relationship with it, to know it.
See, the weird thing is, and I have something so straighten me out here, because basically, it seems to me every vritti is, in a sense, its substance, so to speak, is consciousness.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
So then, even a vritti of an object is basically a sort of consciousness taking a form or something like that. In a certain way, right? It's,
no.
No? Consciousness taking the form of an object.
It doesn't do anything, does it?
Consciousness can't take on any kind of form. It's the mitya, the maya, that takes on the form.
Right. Okay, but still the form, well, I guess what I'm saying is the vritti it's kind of a consciousness taking a form, no? You know what I'm saying?
Because the vritti is maya.
Right.
Also. Now, if you...
I mean, ultimately, I know consciousness isn't doing anything. I know that. But in terms of, in the Via Viharika, if we're gaining knowledge of something, then, at least of it, something that's an object, isn't it, consciousness in some ways, well, it's reflecting the object. I don't know how you talk about it. Maybe I'm not clear of what I'm exactly trying to say here. It seems to me, though, that since there's always consciousness with every vritti, then it almost seems to me more like the opposite of what they're saying. When you know Brahman, there is just consciousness without any particular vritti. No?
Well,
there's pala vyapti without vritti vyapti, because there's no particular form there. You're removing name and form, and it's just...
But you're only removing name and form and all of that from the standpoint of maya. From the standpoint of Brahman, there is no name and form.
Mm-hmm.
Like from the standpoint of the clay, there is no pot. So from the standpoint of consciousness, there is no ignorance, there is no bondage, there's no liberation, there's no teacher-student. None of this is there. That all exists within maya.
Mm-hmm.
There's also no mind. There's no vritti.
Right.
Right? These things... So the whole problem of bondage and liberation and knowledge and ignorance only exists within maya itself.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Not within Brahman. From Brahman, there's no problem at all. And Brahman never does anything.
So that's why there always has to be a vritti, basically. For there to be liberation, or for there to be self-knowledge, there has to be a vritti.
There has to be a vritti, because the ajnanam is beginningless. In other words, there has to be a vritti which differentiates what is maya from Brahman.
Right.
Buddhi is maya. It's mitya. It has to recognize that it has to differentiate itself from the self-shining awareness. And then it realizes that, I am that self-shining awareness, and me, this buddhi, is just mitya. The buddhi realizes it's mitya. And it realizes that the self-shining awareness, what it is always taken to belong to it, is actually infinite and changeless and non-dual. The buddhi recognizes that.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time recognizes itself as mitya. And it can only do that because you are the non-dual awareness, that's yourself, and the buddhi is there.
Now, I know all that, but... All right, maybe I'm a little too tired to articulate. Maybe this...
We can do it tomorrow.
Maybe when I sleep on it, this problem will go away. But there's a little issue that... I can't articulate.
No, but you know what you should do? And this is what I used to do to Swamiji all the time. Mm-hmm. You never mind it at all, either.
Okay.
You just think about it and try to keep trying to get the question, pinpointing the question.
Yeah.
And I keep trying to answer it. That's
okay.
How it is.
Yeah.
And at some point, it works.
Okay.
Because like with Swamiji, I'd go 3, 4, 5 rounds, and then I'd come back the next day, but Swamiji...
Okay.
You just do it until it's clear. and the question becomes more and more refined, and then however I'm trying to answer it at some point actually answers it.
Okay.
Where the question and the answer match up. But it doesn't always match up right away. Sometimes you have to work for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you have to...
For some weird reason, I have this thing in my mind, even though I can understand the way it's taught here, that rather than, with self-knowledge, rather than it being only a vritti vyapti, because you don't need a pala vyapti, because what is known is consciousness itself, so it need not be... It may not be another sort of aspect of illumination, because what the vritti itself is consciousness, right?
Yeah.
I know, so I understand that that's what's being said, but somehow it seems to me more that you don't need the... I want to say you don't need the vritti, because it's just consciousness itself that's known. But
you have to remove the ignorance. So remember, the vritti vyapti is what removes the ignorance.
And since we're talking about something that happens in Via Viharika, there has to be... Something has to happen. There has to be a vritti for knowledge to take place.
That's right, because the problem is ignorance. And from the standpoint of the Atman, there's no ignorance or anything.
From the point of view of Paramartika, it's just consciousness, but then there's no ignorance there either. Right?
No, so not from the standpoint of awareness.
No vritti is necessary.
From the standpoint of awareness, there isn't even a vritti. There's no vritti, there's no universe, there's just me.
Because I have in my mind that a vritti by itself without consciousness is sort of an inert thing.
It would be, but that's why... Mm-hmm. Remember, the vritti is sattva. The vritti itself is sattva, so it has the capacity of as though reflecting consciousness. But that has to be there. The ability to have consciousness as its content... And it has to have the nama-rupa as its content in Vyavahara, you know. And so, say I have a vritti of the fireplace. Now, from that end of it, the ajnanam is gone. But what is also because I've taken on the vritti is taking on that shape. But in order for the thing to be known, I need awareness.
Okay.
So both things have to be happening.
It's like there's a mirror that's reflecting it, but without light to illuminate the mirror, then
it's not known.
The reflection cannot be
known. Yeah, it's not fulfilled. The vritti is not fulfilled because there's no consciousness there.
But in this case, you don't need any other light because what is being reflected is the light itself.
Is the light itself,
so to speak.
Yeah, okay. And so you don't need to bring in another... consciousness to light up the consciousness, which is the very subject of the vritti. It helps, I think, to also realize that when we're doing this kind of talking, it's only from the standpoint of the upadis.
Right.
They're for the standpoint of the buddhi itself. How does knowledge take place in the buddhi when you can't objectify awareness? What is going on? How does it happen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Actually, I believe this right now, what we're doing is very terse, but it will all be quite expanded a little later on with all kinds of examples and talking more and more about it.
And the other thing is the way he talks about removing the ignorance, like removing the covering.
Yeah.
This is an unusual way of talking about how...
Yeah.
I mean, from our normal point of view,
it is, but even saying that there's a covering is problematic.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, but that particular drishtanta, I don't actually like that drishtanta that much, but it's only every drishtanta, every illustration has its limits, and if you go beyond the limits of the drishtanta, it doesn't hold anymore.
See, like what it implies to me, what it brings to my mind is as if it's sort of pausing, kind of like the infinite knowledge of Ishvara, where everything is known. But then for us sort of limited beings, there's an inborn covering of ignorance.
Yes.
That has to then, in individual cases, it's removed. See, if it was Ishvara here, I would know what was behind that wall. But
the limited minds, which are part of the upadhi, like the wave is very limited, it can't really know the ocean, but it can know the water. Right. And it can recognize that every part of its upadhi is part and parcel of the ocean.
Right.
It can know that. But it can't have the vision of the whole ocean. And you can't have, unless like in the 11th chapter, Krishna gives Arjuna this magic divine eye. It's called the Divya Chakshu. This divine eye to see the whole creation.
Yeah.
You know. But otherwise, we can't do
that. But just as a theory of perception, that really is that something, when it becomes known, is because a covering is removed from it.
Well, that's actually true. That there's a lot of discussion about that, because what is already is.
Right.
Right. And so you don't see it yet.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that it isn't.
The ignorance of it is removed, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because we usually think of it that the knowledge is something added rather than the removal.
I know. Right? I know. But when you start understanding it even in that way, somehow that correlates a little bit to even how to live your life.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It's already here. Your life is here, so it's really a matter of, from the beginning, responding to the life, not creating the life. Creating the life means creating your path, as though you have to figure it all out. You're the little pocket of consciousness that has to make your way, make a meaningful life for yourself. Or from a Vedantic or the Shastra point of view, you're the prarabdha karma. Ishwara is just taking place. Your role is already there. You know, you're almost like an actor in the play, and you just have to play your part, which is just dharma. But the life is already there. The universe itself, with all infinite cause and effect in interrelationships, and you're in the middle of all of that. You're in the middle of like an infinite cause and effect cycle of relationships, you know. And then you think that you're the doer, and you have to make this whole thing work. But a jnani will just say, no, I'm just here for the ride, so to speak, doing my best, responding to the world, what it's asking me, what it's asking of me. That's my prarabdha. To the best of my ability. And so I'm just, Swamiji talks like that. And that's all. That's it. I don't do anything else. I just do my best with what's here. Ishwara time. Staying in Ishwara's time. Because the Jiva Srishti is always circling around, thinking about this and thinking about that, and getting upset and worried and imagining. And the thing is, our imaginations are very powerful. They create emotions. You know, if you imagining have catastrophic thinking, it's not objective. It's producing emotions which you suffer from, even though you're in an imaginal world. You know, so people don't think about that. You have to slow way down, because Ishwara is slow. You know, and your imagination is so fast, and then you worry. It's a lot. But if you slow down and even look in hindsight, it always works out. Everything always works out the way that it should. But you have a miserable time waiting for whether or not it is going to work out. And you think it's going to work out one way, but say you think, well, what's going to happen in 5 years? And if you look back 5 years from now, you say, I had no idea. I had no idea at all. But it's perfectly fine. It's how things did go. It's just the foresight I thought I had, I didn't. And that's usually the case, unless you're just looking right around the corner or something. Who would know? You don't know. Because you're not there yet. So it's better just to live your life here, the life that's here, instead of always being in this imaginal world.
It's much more relaxing.
Oh, yeah. It's much more enjoyable. It's more relaxing. It's more enjoyable. We get to actually be in Ishwara Srishti. We're actually being here in the life. You know.
It takes a little more surrender, though, doesn't it?
Surrender is knowledge. Yeah, that surrender that's not knowledge is kind of it's a belief. And we try to believe. You know? But belief isn't knowledge.
What do you mean surrender is knowledge?
Well, we think that we're going to surrender to Ishwara or something, but we don't really know who Ishwara is, and we don't really know what it means to surrender, and we don't know anything about it, really. Yeah, but we know we're supposed to surrender.
Right.
Have some blind faith.
Yeah.
You know. But really, the surrender, the real surrender is knowledge. Because you see the way things are. And so the lack of surrender disappears. I'd say like that.
Yes.
How can you, in the same way that's being described, that you can, that knowledge takes place of who you are, how can that knowledge take place that I know that I am the same as you?
Those are the what we call the different prakriyas, teaching methodologies. But just, I'll give you one, just to see how. If we say we do the drip drisha, the see or seen prakriya, where you're objectifying your body and I'm objectifying mine. We're all, everybody in the room, we're all doing it, objectifying our body. So I'm not the body, the body is objectified. I'm the subject, the body is objectified. But for all of us, everybody in the room. And then the sense organs that are aware of the body, I'm aware of my sense organs, whether they're working or not, or I can see, or I'm blind, all that. All of us are doing that. So we realize, okay, I'm not the sense organs either. Because they're instruments that I'm aware of, and they change, and I know how they're, whether they're working or not working. So they're objectified. So they're also not me. They're the object, not the subject. And then we're all of us together. We're objectifying the mind. All my thoughts, the buddhi, and then the fluctuating thoughts and the emotions. So all of those are objectified also. So those also aren't me, because I'm the subject who's aware of them. But all of us. And then even the ahankara, the I thought, I am going to do this, I am doing that, I am this body, I am smart or stupid or whatever. That ahankara, are you aware of it? Oh, absolutely. You know, are you aware of your emotions? Absolutely aware of them. You know, are you aware of your roles that you're playing in life? Like I'm a mother or a mother or a father or a husband or a wife or a teacher or a student or whatever. All of these roles also. I'm very aware of them, and they can go and change. So now, I can even say I'm aware of everything about my body and my mind and all of these, the experiences they can have, and I'm also aware of time, and I'm aware of space. Right? So, in fact, everything about this creation, including my body, mind, sense organs, I have a subject-object relationship with, and so do you. Now, that being the case, what makes you different from me? Only the things we've negated. I'm not my body, you're not your body. Right? I'm not my sense organs, you're not your sense organs. I'm not my mind, you're not your mind. So now I ask you, what's different for the one that's left standing? What separates us? If you said space, but I'm aware of space and you're aware of space, what's the separation? Only things that are not me. And so then, that's just one example, but what makes me different from you then? You have to try to think of something. Mm-hmm. And anything you think of will be objectified.
So that's in the same way, that's removing the coverings.
Yes, exactly. It's removing the coverings. The coverings are where, they're not actual physical coverings, right? Yeah. They're the points where I make the mistake. Mm-hmm. That's why it's called a upadhi. An upadhi means, if I can say this is me, like this is my body, that means I can superimpose myself on it. That's the covering. It's not an actual covering, it's a mistake that's caused by ignorance. So we call that the covering. So I have to peel off these coverings. Yeah. Through teaching. Because you can see, yes, this body is objectified through the sense organs. If I didn't have my sense organs, I wouldn't even know about this body. The only reason I have any relationship with it at all is through my five sense organs. You know? And what about the sense organs? I can lose, you know, my sense organs. But my mind, I don't lose my mind. My mind is aware that my eyes are not working, or it's aware I've lost my hearing. So that means the eye is not affected, the organ is affected. So you keep going until you can't go any farther. You end up just in conscious being. That itself can't be objectified, but it need not be objectified because it's self-evident. And you've just, this teaching, the prakriya, the teaching methodology, has stripped off all of the things that I had mistakenly superimposed on myself.
But the Dehatma Buddhi is so strong.
So.
Even though you sort of can see this, the feeling still is, I'm here, you're there.
Yeah.
You can't be.
That'll always be there, though, but it'll be mitya.
It'll be known to be mitya.
Mitya. Mitya means the stability, that your own nature is is very well discerned, differentiated. Mm-hmm. In other words, two things are happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There's this mitya, mm-hmm. and the body having the sense of self and all that. That's not going to go away.
Okay.
But the sense of self, the self has been liberated.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, that stable, changeless self, which is never away from any experience and never changes, that is also dominant. Like right now, right now, if I bring that into high relief,
mm-hmm.
my being is dominant. This the changelessness of my being, mm-hmm. and all these, this mitya universe is here, and all of our relationships and everything is all here. But it's all here, along with my dominant self. Dominant means that it's very much recognized by the buddhi.
Okay, so you say you could, you actually still have in a way the sensation.
Oh yeah,
that this body is me.
Yeah,
and your body is you, but you have some kind of a knowledge. But it goes beyond just an intellectual knowledge. There's also almost like a feeling thing.
Oh yeah,
that the self. Actually, you could just as well say that the consciousness is somewhere in the middle of the room or pervading the entire room.
Or, I do say
or the room is within the consciousness itself, like a little bubble inside the consciousness. You could as well say that, but at the same time, you still have this strong feeling.
The feeling
that I'm here, you're there,
but
yet
that,
you know you're not, right? It's kind of
both like, things are there.
Okay.
You know, like if I say the satyam, this is really the understanding of satyam mitya. See, with a clay pot, the pot still feels like I am a clay pot.
Mm-hmm.
From the standpoint of the pot, I am a clay pot. But if it's a jnani pot, it knows, it still feels, I am a clay pot.
Mm-hmm.
But the pot, that the clay that I am, is changeless and free.
Mm-hmm.
So both sides it knows.
Okay.
So I would feel, yes, I am a conscious being. You know?
Okay.
But the conscious being that I am is completely free and non-dual.
So that mitya experience, never really, that doesn't have to go anywhere.
It can't, once you know that it's mitya, mm-hmm. that's it. Because to know that it's mitya, you have to know the satyam. Otherwise it's not mitya for you, right?
Yeah.
It's just a concept.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any meaning. But if you recognize that it's mitya, that means that you recognize from its own standpoint, you know, I am that. Like if the pot says I am clay, that's not false. It is nothing but clay.
Yeah.
So if I say I am a conscious being, that is not false. That's true. I am a conscious being, but I need to know that the consciousness is satyam, mm-hmm. is changeless. It's a different order of reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's non-objectifiable. It's the substratum. It's the substrate being of maya. It's the rope of the snake, you know. So so that's why sometimes when we do the meditation, I'll say something like, Let the buddhi gently focus on your own presence, on your own being. And then I'll say that for a while, and then I'll say, just be yourself. Because otherwise, you're stuck with the buddhi. The ahankara is with the I notion, is with the buddhi. And the buddhi is gently focusing on the self. Right? So, but now you have to recognize that actually the self that the buddhi is focusing on is itself. So just be it. Be the self that you are. You know, and let the buddhi enjoy you. Mm. This subtle little shift that takes place. Mm. To just own, to put the ahankara with the, where it belongs. Ahankara means the I notion. Let the aham, the me, the I, be with me. You know? And then that me, changeless me, becomes more dominant in the buddhi also. Mm-hmm. In the mind. Because it's already dominant in the mind, but the mind is off doing this and doing that, looking in this direction and that direction, not appreciating. Mm-hmm. Not appreciating the truth of your, of itself, which is free and changeless and non-dual. Nothing can touch you. Not even, Swamiji will joke sometimes, not even Ishwara. Ishwara can't do anything. Because he has the same adhishtana, the same non-dual, non-objectifiable self. So what's he going to do? You know? So that's... It's probably really for Bhagavan also.